Coming to you live from the Jim Butler Ballroom at the Mitzvah Hotel, it's time for another commute with your hosts, Faye and Brenda. This is Drive Time to Nova.
What are you doing? I hear you in the background making a noise.
I'm filling my drink up with drink.
Drink? Would that be non-alcoholic drink?
It would be, yes. It would be a very nice, fuzzy, bubbly glass of water.
Oh. Well, beverages aside, this is Drive Time to Nopa. I am Brenda Boo, and who are you?
I am the Faye Driver.
So, did that drink come from your brand new soda stream?
Guilty. It certainly did.
Oh,
yes.
Nice. Have you grown accustomed to having it in your home?
Yeah, it's kind of a not heavily used, but it's a nice change from when you're thirsty and you want something, but you don't want sugary drink, which is a real, you know, like standard go-to is to get a pop or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have, to be able to just load up a bottle of fizzy water.
So the next time I come to stay or even just spend an afternoon with you, I will, of course, be demanding a taste test.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because I love the bubbly whatevers.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also all these flavored water, the flavorings you can get, too. Mm-hmm. So I have many opinions about some of the various flavors.
Ooh, we could do a little taste test.
We could.
Like you could, before your wedding, you did that, remember?
When we the champagne tasting.
Yeah, you even had like a form that you typed up and printed out for us. It was all very official.
Yes, mm-hmm. Your grading scale.
Mm-hmm. So, Faye, it's been a while since we've done a Drive Time to Nopa episode.
I know. We could be voiding our contract for not sticking to our rules.
Well, it's hard to record when you're in another country altogether. Although we do that all the time, because right now you're in another country. I forget.
Well, technically you are correct. But yes, I was out of Canada for a period of time.
You were on the island.
The wee little island of Ireland.
So I want to talk to you about it. Get some even more details, because by the time you hear this, I'm sure you'll have put out your Pink Wheel Nuts episode where you gave some initial thoughts about your trip and a lot of things you experienced, right?
Yes, certainly. Yes.
All right. So if I repeat anything, feel free to let me know and we'll go on to another topic, okay?
Sure thing. Mm-hmm. You bet.
All right. So in order to get to Ireland, you had to go to your local airport. And I just want to touch upon the whole experience of the minute you walk in any airport terminal in any place of the world. What is your experience? Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it neutral? Is it someplace you would go if you absolutely didn't have to go to an airport?
Yeah, it is always, it's basically an unpleasant experience, isn't it?
It is.
Because first of all, the first thing you do, you walk in the door and you're immediately greeted with a state of confusion because where do I have to go to plug in my ticket, my load up, give them my luggage, sign in, check in, whatever it is. I mean, even though you might sign in online, you still got to go through some kind of a queue before they'll let you on the plane. Mm-hmm. In fact, several queues.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the first thing is to find my airline and the check-in desk and all that. Because when I fly with luggage. So it's a requirement that I must hand my luggage over.
Mm-hmm.
To the apes and baboons that throw it around underneath in the basement of the airport, right?
God, do they throw that shit around. Mm-hmm. You see them throwing it in when you're actually in the plane and you look down and you're like, wow, they're just tossing my luggage around. Like mm-hmm. It's a bat, you know, like a thing of hay, you know. It's just like, anyway, carry on.
So you do that. But then just like overall, when you start to go through the airport experience, it's like it's the whole thing about hurry, 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 and wait.
Oh, yes.
Hurry, 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 wait. You have to get here on time or else you might miss your plane. Oh, you're here. Okay, sit there for an hour. Mm-hmm. Right? And, of course, you know, some passengers or some people you might travel with might be much more concerned about this kind of thing. Now, I admit, I am very time conscious, so I am guilty, but you know, I've gamed this system out, and I know you do not really have to be at the airport 2 hours before the plane leaves. You know, there's a bit of wiggle room there, right?
I would hope so.
So there's not always this big rush, but we all get a little antsy when we're going, oh my God, I've only got 2 hours before I step on this plane and we're not even at the airport yet, right?
Right.
Because there's this aura of failure and doom that you're never going to get. You won't get through the security, and you won't find your gate, and you'll be there late, and you'll miss the call, and all this kind of stuff, right?
What about, have you ever had them, when they x-ray your luggage, they're like, oh, they pull yours aside, and they start digging through it?
Oh, yes.
And how does that make you feel?
It's happened to me.
The swab?
Yeah, so now the new thing now is we'd like to swab your bags, please. And they rub their paper thing, a paper filter doodad, all over your bag. And they stick it in the drug detector. Mm-hmm. And so you're waiting to see whether they are going to, you know, arrest you because their little computerized sniffer has found coke or something else.
Explosives.
Right. So... that used to make me nervous.
Why would that be, Faye?
Well, you never know. But, you know, I'm less worried about that kind of stuff. In fact, I am often pegged for search.
Huh.
This happens to me so often that I don't even care. And then I don't like to go through the scanning machines. You know, like they have these new machines that you step into and...
Yes.
You know, they... x-ray you or who knows what they're doing to you.
And they see you're naked.
Right.
You have to put your hands on your head and straddle and mm-hmm. God knows what they're seeing and thinking. What a job that would be. Oh my God.
Yeah. So I refuse that, which generally means I get a pat down or, you know, some sort of bodily search.
Nope. Bodily, you say? Don't they just pat you down?
Well, yeah, but their hands are on your body.
Oh, okay. Well, can I tell you one time, I think it was on the way home from visiting you, I think, I had a thing of lotion, and I actually just bought it. It was like a $7 thing, and it was on my carry-on, and the guy behind the counter is like, says, this is too big. And then he started giving me all the options of what I could do. Did I have somebody who could come pick it up? Did I want to... And it was just like... Yes, fine. Throw it away. You have my permission. It was such a big rigmarole for this lotion.
Yeah.
And it was, I just want, as he was giving me all my options, I just wanted to tell him to shut up and throw it away. Mm-hmm. But anyway. Yeah, whenever I travel, I get myself to that gate, and then I'm like, I feel like I can't move. And then, of course, if you have your carry-on, you have to drag that shit everywhere, right? You
gotta
take it into the bathroom. If you want to go buy a $5 bottle of water, you got to drag it with you. And mm-hmm. and you kind of become enslaved in this weird kind of overpriced community, don't you?
Yes, exactly. They don't let you bring anything with you, like because it's illegal for you to have a bottle of water. Because, you know, you could kill somebody with it. And so then you got 2 hours to spend and you probably missed breakfast because you were in a mad rush to get to the airport and all that. So then you get to this place where, yeah, you're at the mercy of the ridiculous prices. And it's just like one big cattle call.
It does. You feel exactly like cattle. And when you see people are like, oh, the people in A can start loading. And you're right. Like, why are they better than me? How come I always have to wait to the last thing to get on? Becomes very... How much do you glare at the first class passengers when you go by?
Well, I tend not to.
Oh, okay.
Although, you know what? When I was boarding this plane, there was a guy in the first class, and we were, you know how, you know, getting onto these bloody planes, it's like someone is trying to get their bag up into the overhead, and so all the lane is completely stopped up. Mm-hmm. There's 40 people waiting.
Yep.
For one person to lift their bag. Oh, I'm too weak and feeble. Can somebody help me? So anyway, we were stopped, and I was standing right in front of this man, and he never took his eyes off of me. He watched me the entire time that I was standing there, which was like 60 seconds or 90 seconds or something. And I mean, we were having this staring contest. It was very eerie. He was like, he was looking at me like, what kind of a freak are you? And I was looking at him like, well, what kind of a freak are you staring at me? God. I mean, I don't look so weird today, do I?
I'm sure you didn't. Were you making eye contact?
Yeah, like eye to eye, like just like piercing stare down at this guy sitting in first class.
Oh, wow.
Just looking me up and down and like right in the face.
Well, it didn't occur to you to look away?
Well, I did. I looked away to see what's the problem down the aisle, and I looked back, and he's there right on me. Ding!
Wow. You
know, zeroed in on me. And like, I don't know, what are you thinking? I'm going to come up and steal your fancy seat?
I don't know. I always think it's interesting, too, when you're in that row or you're in the aisle and you're trying to get down. And then so somebody puts their thing up and you're like, oh, good, we're going to move. And then somebody who's already sitting in their seats will pop up and go into the bin and get their book or magazine or whatever. I'm like, really? Fucktard? You couldn't wait until we all sit down and then you start doing this bullshit? They're so selfish. That's what gets me about the airport situation, the society. I've never seen a more self-involved concentration of people in my life.
Right. And this was... Now, this flight was a long flight. It was actually 9.5 hours was the flight time from takeoff to touchdown.
Yikes.
And then, of course, you can add in all the taxiing around and stuff. Mm.
Was it a hot airplane? Did you feel cool? Were you comfortable?
I'm telling you, this fucking airplane was so hot. And we're 35,000 feet above the ground and it's minus 51 degrees Celsius up there, I'll have you know.
Mm.
So you'd think it might be a little cool, but they had the heat cranked in that bloody airplane. And several of us were hot. And several people said, it's awfully hot in here. Can we turn the heat down? And one steward, or one flight attendant, said, yes, the captain is adjusting the temperature. And then, like an hour later, I said, like, come on, it's so hot in here. Why is it so hot in here? And a different flight attendant said, one of the passengers was feeling cool. Well, so that means the other 279 of us have to suffer for one person.
Right. Give her a second DNA-covered blanket and tell her to shut up.
Right. Oh, yeah, and those stupid little blankets. Okay, so now this is a long flight, and it's a red eye, right? We left at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. and we arrived in 8 a.m. Dublin time.
Aye.
So you're supposed to be sleeping through the flight. Impossible.
Good luck.
Anyway, they give you this blanket and pillow set, all wrapped up in plastic, quite nicely. The problem is, these things are such a pain in the ass, you barely have enough room to jam your own ass into the seat. And then you have to now take care of this blanket and pillow set like it's some kind of baby you've just received. and you can't do anything with it. There's no room because there's nowhere to put the frickin' things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there on the flight back, there happened to be one seat that wasn't taken in our zone. And there were like 8 blankets piled onto this seat. And they were falling all over the place and falling at my feet and getting in the way of my feet. And the food cart would come by and the blankets would be falling into the aisle and they'd be stepping on them and driving over them with their food cart and stuff. These things were just a nuisance. And it was so bloody hot anyway. Whoever would have needed a blanket must have been a corpse of some kind. I mean, it was kind of dumb. Like, I don't want this thing. Get it away from me. I ended up putting mine and Mr. Anderson's up in the overhead bin because we had room in our bin.
And you said that they didn't have that little thing that I've seen on every airplane. Every airplane I've ever been on, the thing that you can adjust the little rush of air, they didn't have that in your plane?
No, it was that there was no air controls at all. For starters, the ceiling was really high. Like the ceiling was probably 4 feet, 5 feet over your head, above your head, standing. So there was no way you could possibly reach the ceiling, not from your seat anyway. You might be able to stand on your chair and touch the ceiling. So I guess that's maybe why they didn't include air vents, because you wouldn't have been able to adjust them unless they had some sort of remote control on your armrest or something. Having experienced this extreme heat on the way over, I decided I am not dressing for the trip back. So I was wearing the shorts and a t-shirt with a sleeveless shirt for the trip back. And several people were commenting, wow, look, well, you're certainly dressed light.
Well, I know better.
Right. And I was still hot. I was wearing nothing.
Did you tell them on Pink Wheel Nuts the seat that you were in?
No.
So you couldn't have had a worse seat in terms of the whole plane, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. So I had the center. Yeah, so this airplane had, there were two aisles. There was, so the window side had two seats on it. And in the center, there were a three-seat section, and then the other window side was another two seats. So what's that? 7 seats across. Mm-hmm. A two-setter, a three-setter, and a two-setter, right?
Right.
Incidentally, if you wanted to get a window seat, this airline charged an extra $100 if you wanted the window side, like one of the two window seats. Jeez. $100 extra.
That's a lot.
Yeah. We didn't opt for that option. So I got stuck in the very middle seat for the flight over to Dublin. I guess this was probably a contributing factor because I was seated in between, you know, one hot body and another hot body, mm-hmm. generating heat. But even coming back, I was right next to the aisle. Mr. Anderson and I swapped, and it was still hot. Like, I don't, it's just so hot. And the funny thing is, I found the whole country of Dublin very hot.
Really?
Like every one of these hotels, anywhere we went, everything seems to be heated by hot water radiators, you know, pretty old technology, but certainly is reliable. So every place we went to had these radiators on the wall, and they were all just blasting the heat out. And they were very hard to control. Like when I could turn them off, I definitely turned them all off. But still, the heat emanating from the houses in this country, it was almost unbearable to me.
And I'm sure they didn't have air conditioning, just like Washington State doesn't feel like they need air conditioning, right?
Yeah,
so there's no duct work or anything. No,
not at all.
Well, I just want to say, unless you want to say more about the trip on the plane, I have two things. listening to you talk about this reminds me of, like, I have two pieces of equipment that would have helped you immensely. Things that you probably would never use any other place in life.
Yes.
One of them is the horseshoe pillow, which is just it's like a miracle when you're in one of those seats, you know. You can kind of put your head to the side on your shoulder and rest a little bit. And then I also have this fan that's on a string. It's a little tiny fan. It's about the size of a cell phone, and it blows up, and it blows. It'd be blowing right up underneath on your chin, and how that would have been just wonderful to have.
Yes.
But in order to think about all these potential things that you might need on the airplane, then you have to carry it with you,
stow it.
And I just want to talk about the considerate lady in front of you.
Oh, yes. And I want to tell you about this flight attendants as well.
Okay.
So, lucky us, for the flight over to Dublin, we were sat behind this very gregarious lady whose name is Sherry. I don't mind telling you, or Cheryl. Cheryl or Sherry. I know this because she had with her one of the most gigantic iPads I have ever seen. It wasn't like a normal iPad, like the big, you know, the big iPads?
Yeah.
They're about the size of a sheet of paper.
Uh-huh. 8.5 by 11.
Yeah. This iPad was like 2 times as big as a normal iPad.
Wow.
It was so big that she had propped it up, you know, on her tray table and the back seat of the person in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was as big as the width of the chair.
Wow. That's big.
So here she was with this iPad, and she was very chatty. She was chatting up everybody. Anybody who would look, if you accidentally made eye contact with her, that was it. You were done, man. So from listening to her conversation, because she didn't talk quietly, I found out where she lived, what she did for a living. She was traveling with her sister. It was her sister's birthday. They were going to Ireland. I don't think she was treating her sister to this trip or something. I'm not sure. And she was getting really cozy with the fellow on the end of the lane, you know, the third seat, who was traveling by himself, who was kind of a, you know, handsome man. And I heard him, we ended up sitting beside him in the waiting for the plane to come.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to another friend, and he was like, just like a typical misogynist male, talking about women and stuff, like icky, you know.
Do you remember anything he said in particular?
Oh, it was just stuff about girls he's dated, and they were talking about the two guys were going to a wedding or something, and they were talking about their bridesmaids they were going to connect up with.
Uh-oh. Were they homely?
And it was like, I wonder if we're going to get any from our bridesmaids, you know.
Ew.
That kind of gross. That level of respect for women.
Mm.
Anyway, so, like, I was convinced that the Sherry and the dude were going to be, like, doing it in the bathroom or something.
Ew. There's no room in that bathroom to have any kind of sex.
And Sherry was very, very happy to buy drinks for everybody. She bought drinks for the entire row that she was in.
Hmm.
Here, you know, the dude.
Hey, dude.
And her sister and herself. Not just one drink, because you know how spotty the service is on these airlines.
Mm-hmm.
So she was on top of it. She was like, oh, I'll take 3 for me and 3 for my sister and 2 for the dude. So she had like racks and racks of bottles there. Anyway,
we need to get back to the size of this iPad.
Yeah.
Because she had discovered what app on her iPad.
So I don't know if she just got this thing like the day before or something. But she was diddling around with every single app that came on that thing. She tested every one. And I could see this because I could see from the crack between her seat, you know, the seat in front of, she was in front of us, I could see through the crack right onto her gigantic, very bright screen, everything that she was doing. And she gets into this GarageBand software.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of us use GarageBand for editing, those of us who do podcasts. But GarageBand will also allow you to play instruments. So there's like a guitar that you can strum along, bling, 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 bling. And there's a drum set. Tick-tock, tick-tock, boom, boom, ch-ch, boom, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. Well, she, of course, didn't have the decency to plug in any headphones. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning as we're flying across the Atlantic Ocean. And all of a sudden you hear this boom-chuck, boom-chuck, ding-ding-ding-ding. She's got her volume cranked up and she's playing the drums when everyone's zonked out trying to sleep on this flight from hell. And she's having the best time ever, you know.
I'm surprised you didn't reach up your little finger and tap her on the shoulder and say, "Excuse me, Cheryl, do you think you could turn the volume down on your toy?"
Yes, I suppose I could have. I didn't. That's funny.
Because that really feels like within your personality.
Yeah.
To say something.
Right.
Like, I'm surprised the steward didn't say something like, "You know, it's 3 in the morning."
I know. And then there is, you know, everything's dark. And then there's this halo, like a light from heaven above is shining out from Cheryl's seat because she's got this gigantic iPad just painting the entire aircraft with light.
Yeah.
And I was right behind her. And I put that one of those damn pillows. I stuffed the pillow up in the crack between her seat. So I could block the light from shining in my face when I was trying to sleep.
Good Lord.
It was really not very considerate, I must say.
So did they feed you at all? Or did they just ply you with liquor?
No, actually, I was quite pleased. We got this very cute little meal. It was a hot meal.
Oh, nice.
And it was piping hot, in fact. Came in this little rectangular box with a tin foil lid. And there was, I had chicken with roasted vegetables and, I don't know, some peas or something, something else in there. Some sort of a pasta-y type, saucy, risotto type thing. I don't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was very delicious. Mr. Anderson had pasta, which like a rigatoni with tomato sauce, which was very nice. You got a little teeny tiny miniature-sized piece of bread. And I don't know, some cookies and a couple other things, mm-hmm. couple of small things, and a miniature-sized bottle of water, like probably 4 ounces of water.
Ooh. Don't want you going to the bathroom any more than you have to, I guess.
So actually the meal was really good. It was delicious, and it was hot, so I was very impressed by that. And then they gave us a snack as well.
Well, that was
later,
good.
Later in the flight.
Well, we have been talking for the last half an hour basically about just the mode that you got there. Mm-hmm. So let's get you to Ireland. You've been on this long flight. You've had almost no sleep. You are in the tiniest portion. Like, you're in the most constricted part of the airplane. Mm-hmm. Your body has probably moved less than 2 inches while you're sitting in that chair. You're like a statue. You go out. It's what time when you get to Ireland?
So we arrived at 8:30. We got out into the real air about 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
So you talked into the pouring rain.
Oh, yes. So you had talked about the rigmarole of just getting to your car and all that stuff.
Right. We got our car. We'll skip over that. We finally got a nice little car and started driving on the wrong side of the road, which ended up to be not too terribly confusing, but you certainly did have to pay attention to what you were doing.
Mm-hmm. I was to say that this was not an automatic. I thought you got an automatic, but you got a, a four speed or five speed?
Yeah, standard. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, like, I think it would be hard enough just to drive everything's opposite and then trying to shift too. And you were talking about that this was all very challenging on your back.
Yes.
And once I found out you had a standard, I was like, well, geez, no wonder you were contorting yourself absolutely opposite. And if you are in any kind of slow traffic, you're constantly shifting, right?
Right, yeah.
So what I wanted to touch on was, like, you show up, you get to Ireland, you're already in the negative, you're already tired, your body is already feeling the pains, and now you're responsible for transporting you and your husband across this country that you've never stepped foot in before. And you have this itinerary, you have reservations, you know, so many days, you're going to be here, you're going to be there. I thought you were crazy for trying to undertake all this. So it's just like, this sounds so stressful. Uh-huh. And that's what I want to ask you about. The level of stress, did it start from the get-go, or did it, I mean, talk me through it. I know you got to a certain point when things got better, but it was kind of hellish for a while, wasn't it? Because you were so tired?
Yeah, definitely the fatigue and the stress of being in a different country. You know, for the very first part of it, like getting the car, it was a bit of an adventure. It was kind of fun to figure out how do you shift with the wrong hand and, you know, getting used to the gears, moving the gears with your other hand. And the feet are all the same. So, the footwork was easy.
Mm-hmm.
But then just like orienting yourself to being on the other side of the car with cars coming at you the wrong way and all that kind of stuff. Plus, the roads are so tiny, too.
But it would have been your dominant hand. So was that helpful or not?
No. I still, for the first 2 days or so, I really had to think about what I was doing with that shifter, especially if I had to change into reverse.
Yeah.
Reverse was a challenge for me because where is reverse? I don't understand.
Yes.
I really cognitate about getting into reverse or switching from first to reverse or reverse to first. It was just a bit of a challenge. But I eventually my body got used to that. So that ended up being not as bad.
Okay.
So, yeah, the first part of it was fine. It started out as a bit of a fun adventure. Plus, we had the benefit of this GPS system. And that, if we did not have that GPS, I'm telling you, one of the two of us would have been dead for sure.
Oh, no.
I'm serious. There's no way you can navigate around that country. I don't care where you're going. There's no way you'd be able to get anywhere without having some sort of assistance. I mean, I think some people did it, but I don't know how they did it.
Yes, it's stressful too. Like, because, like you say, at first you're kind of running on adrenaline, right? You get there, you're so excited. Here we are. Wow, it's even more beautiful than I thought it was going to be. And now you're getting down to the brass tacks of the actual trip of trying to get places and experience the country.
And then the first thing you experience when you leave the airport is, like, basically you're immediately on the freeway system too, right?
Yeah.
So you have to, all of a sudden, you're on a freeway and you're expected to be driving freeway speeds, and you have to be careful about what lane you're in because, you know, these are like 4-lane freeways and two of them become different freeways and two of them go, you know, maybe where you would like to be going. So you got to be like, okay, what's happening? Where am I going?
Oh, no.
And you got lorries on your back and stuff like that, right?
Oh.
So we made several errors at the beginning because of the terminology that the Irish GPS lady uses was not familiar to us either, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a bit of miscommunication. And then my left and my right, you know, this is a problem for me to begin with.
Right.
So I'm convinced I'm turning the wheel, you know, one way, which means left, but in it's not right. My brain has a backwards. So we ended up really relying on that GPS to get us back on track. And we did take a couple of wrong exits, and we went the wrong way, and we ended up back at the airport. You know, the first time we left, we were back at the airport within 15 minutes.
Oh, I guess let's start over. Sometimes it's easier just to start over if you're going the wrong direction.
Plus, you have no context about the country. Like, nope. All of a sudden, that you're now getting off an exit and you're going into like the heart of the downtown city, and now you're in amongst buildings and parked cars, and you don't really know where you are and how far are we from this destination, and so everything is new. So it was exciting but confusing.
Well, you had said to me that on paper, a lot of times you would look at the trip and it's like, oh, this is only 90 miles, no problem.
Yeah.
But then you would get on the road, which was little more than a cow path.
Right.
It would take you hours to get through. Mm-hmm.
They had the most amazing paved cow trails in that country. It's unbelievable. And I'm seriously not even exaggerating. It's like what you would consider someone's long driveway paved, but this is a road. This is the road that every car uses both ways, and it's barely wide enough for one car, what we would consider wide enough for one car in this country.
Did you mention that there was no shoulders before?
Yeah, I did talk about pink wheel nuts about the shoulders. Well, maybe not in this. The shoulders, I mean, there are these roads. These are like fast freeway or like, you know, highway style roads, which is one, just two lanes, right? One lane north, one lane south, whatever, opposing traffic. And there's no shoulder. There is no shoulder to speak of, because as soon as the pavement ends, which is where the line is that they paint on the outside line of the road, it's grass, and not just grass going off into, you know, a ditch or something. It's grass that's 4 feet high that runs the entire length of the highway.
Yikes.
So you're driving along. You could roll down the passenger window and stick your hand out and get your hand whacked by grass.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
And signposts and mailboxes and whatever else, you know, the rock walls. They really love their rock walls there.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, can I tell you, when I was on the East Coast, the roads were like that too, and there was lots and lots of rock walls too, because according to the people we talked to there, the farmers, in order to get the land so you could plow it, were always finding rocks, and the rocks would go to the side of the property and they became the walls. And there was no shoulder to speak of either. And like when I lived in North Carolina, we noticed that too, and we were talking about it once we moved back to Iowa, and I was like, why is the difference? Because you get back to Iowa and you got these big shoulders. And somebody said, rightly so, that the shoulders are meant to accommodate farm equipment. Mm. So I'm wondering, you know, Ireland is not the most industrial country I've ever,
right.
You know, I'm surprised, you know, that they wouldn't have accommodations for that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, they just drove down. The tractors were driving down the road, just like everybody else. You know,
oh, God.
You come around a corner where you can't see around any of the corners because there's trees and grass that, you know, this line 8 feet high, so you have no visibility of anything that's coming up like we might hear, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could meet anything around that corner, basically.
Yikes.
I did find, though, that, I mean, they all must be used to this, because you'd never see anybody standing in the middle of the road or a car pulled over, because they all know you're going to get killed if you stay on this road, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did you feel like that you fit in? Like, I've been just in my own country, on the other side of the country, walking around being a tourist, and had people, locals, come up, and like they knew that I was a tourist just based on what I was wearing. Did you feel like you fit in, melded into the locals, or did you feel like you stood out?
Well, I don't feel like we stood out, but I feel that we were definitely noted as outsiders.
Okay, that's all I meant.
But I don't think nobody ever made me feel like I wasn't welcome or that, oh, we see you, you tourist.
No, I didn't mean that either. I meant like we'd be at a restaurant waiting for a table and we wouldn't have said two words to them. And they were like, oh, well, since you're from out of town, you'd enjoy doing this. And I'm how the hell do you know I don't live here? I didn't know. I was just wearing shorts and a t-shirt. It was nothing ridiculous. So,
yeah. One thing interesting, the service at the restaurants was kind of interesting because you would come in, they would seat you down, they would hand you menus, they would take your order, and then they would disappear. They might bring back your drinks or your wine or whatever you ordered, your beverages, and then the food would come, and they'd never see a server again until you went up to pay for your... They wouldn't even bring you a bill, right? Until you went up to the till to pay for your meal. So there was...
They didn't care whether it was right or good or anything?
No. I mean, I don't know that they didn't care. I just think this is the way... This is the method they do here. You've been served. We're done with you. eat and get the fuck out, right?
Hope this is what you wanted.
Right. So, I mean, they were accommodating. If I got someone's attention, they would come and help. But we finally started to see this trend where this is the way the service works around here. And, you know, in Canada and America, we're always tipping. And they don't have a tipping culture there for, although they say, for meals. The only thing you really tip for would perhaps be for meals. So I would attempt to leave a tip or to give a tip or to say, just give me, you know, just give me a five back or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't. They would refuse. They would give me all of the proper change back. Hmm. And so it's a non-tipping culture, I think.
So they must, maybe they get paid a living wage?
Yeah, so they do. The literature I saw says most places pay appropriately, that tips are not an issue and people don't earn by tips.
Huh. Can you tell me whether when you were in... say the lounge at one of the castle hotels that you stayed. Did you see any kind of indication of why Irish people have the reputation of being drunkards?
I would say not.
Well, that wouldn't be a local. That probably wouldn't be where a local person would come and hang out, right? You were in tourist type areas.
No, these were fairly high-end hotels that we were staying in. Mm-hmm. So you didn't see a lot of the local culture because of all the stack of Canadians, partly. All the hotels were just filled with us, right?
Right.
There was one place where there was a wedding. I mean, this was kind of a wedding-centric hotel. They were actually hosting the national wedding show a couple days after we were staying there. So this particular hotel is fairly well known for its weddings. Anyway, every day that we stayed there two nights. There was some wedding going on. So we did see, it was interesting to see. That was the one place where we saw the most Irish people was when the weddings were in town, right?
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and like I pulled up to the front gate, like, you know, every hotel has a pull up here, get out of the car, leave your car, we'll take your bags and go check in and blah, blah, blah. Well, there were a bunch of wedding dudes hanging out right at the front end. And I pulled up and I said, can I park here? Is this the thing to do? Are you guys about to take pictures? Or, you know, I'm just chatting with these people to make sure I wasn't getting in their way for their wedding shots or anything like that. I know. Come on in. You leave your car there. They'll look after you. Go on inside. All these guys were bullshitting and they all had beers and they were just yakking and stuff. And, you know, just had a nice, friendly conversation.
Nice. So can I ask you... you said some of these places where you stayed were really retrofit into hotel rooms. So there was a certain amount of, I would call, rustic charm going on.
Definitely.
Did you mention that Mr. Anderson knocked his little noggin a few times?
No. Yeah, like most of the places we stayed were what they call manor houses. So it wasn't, indeed, a lot of them were like the Fawlty Towers situation where you're living, you're going into somebody's old home, family home, mm-hmm. from way back when. And the buildings, they were quite lovely, right? Mm-hmm. And they're so old, and all the furniture is all handmade, and
was there any IKEA there?
Not a sight of it.
Good, that's good.
And everything's antiques, and one place had a grand piano in one of the sitting rooms, and
nice.
The furniture, all the detail work in some of this furniture, like you know all these filigrees and. There, one of the places we stayed in had end tables for the bed that looked like they came from, they sort of had an Asian flair to them. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of black and gold and inlaid, inlay gold work and stuff. And then the drawers on this one table were so unique. It was like a Chinese puzzle where every side of the table had a drawer on it of the varying sizes. And they all fit together kind of like a little puzzle. It was so charming. Mm-hmm. And
is that the place where he hit his head, though?
No.
Oh, okay.
So we had this Hobbit room. It was so interesting. So I mentioned on my place, we went to this place. We pulled up and my back was so sore. I asked, is there a hot tub here? Oh, no, sir. This is a period house.
Oh.
So this was a super old house, which was about four stories. Mm-hmm. And we were on the very top story, which was the attic of the house. And so we had to walk up these four flights of stairs. And the first two flights were like a grand staircase, right?
Mm-hmm.
All with wood and carpeted stairs and just, you know, old carpet with all the little designs in the going up the edges and stuff like that. Just really intricate.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had another two flights of stairs up, like
servants.
You know, the servants' quarters.
Yep.
And the first door to get into the place, into the room, had the old skeleton key, like mm-hmm. the big steel key with just a notch and a hook on it.
I'm familiar with those, yep.
You had to stick the key in and turn it, like turn and turn and turn. Are we doing this properly? So that was interesting. And the door handles were all brass, and like some of them felt like they were about to fall off in your hand. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, just all this old metalwork. And so, but this particular door was like only about 5 feet high. Like you had to duck your head. You opened the door, you had to duck your head down to get into the place. And then the bathroom door, and so you're in the attic, so you have the slant of the roof is at the walls of your room are slanted, and about three out of the four walls all had slants on them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the bed was right over you know, one side of the room, and poor Mr. Anderson, every time he got out of bed, he would whack his head on the side. I was all hobbled with my sore back and bent over, so that wasn't an issue for me.
Oh, no. He was getting a concussion just trying to go to the bathroom in the morning.
Well, and then I got to tell you about the bathroom door. This bathroom door was cut in a slant as well, because the wall to get into the bathroom was at an angle. So the door, one side of the door would be about as high as your eyesight, the line of eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a slant to the opposite side of the door. And, you know, so it was like a completely custom made door.
Right.
To fit this goofy sort of, you know, old attic hotel room. So
you said that, I think it was you said in this particular room, the windows were very tiny, right?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what kind of fire code issues?
I mean, yeah, like, definitely.
How would you have gotten out if the place had gone up in flames? I mean, would you have been totally screwed?
Yeah, the only option would be to get out, leave out your hobbit door.
Yeah.
But at least there were stairs right there.
Yeah, right.
But there was a fire extinguisher, like, right outside the door. I think there were two fire extinguishers and a fire hose were right there. But, yeah, definitely. Probably not up to today's code.
Well, I wonder, my next question is, was there any point when you were getting along in this trip that you would have traded these very charming, rustic places that you're staying in for just a modern hotel room that might have a hot tub where you didn't have to duck your head? Did you get to that point, or was it always just like worth it? Was it just...
Well, actually, by the time we had arrived at this place, the Hobbit Hotel,
mm-hmm.
I was starting to get a little tired of these strange rooms.
Yeah.
And I had asked, are you full? Are there any better rooms? There were no room. Any of the hotels we stayed in, there were no other rooms because they were fully booked. Mm. Which is funny, being October, right?
Yeah.
But I think it was because of this bloody deal that we all got. We had just inundated all the Irish hotels with all these bloody Canadians and their driving tours. But the other, after that last Hobbit hotel, the next hotel we stayed in was very modern. Much more modern. And it had even had a weight room and a pool and a hot tub that you could use. And so it was a different story. So there was a good sampling of different styles of rooms, but primarily we were staying in manor houses.
So I guess the last thing I want to chat with you about is the actual culture. Now, whenever you come down to the Americas, you say that you can feel the difference when you cross the border. And I feel the same way. When I go over up into Canada, I feel like there's a difference, even though you probably wouldn't think that, you know, the U.S. and Canada are very similar. And do you think that the sampling of locals that you saw was something that you appreciated, could acclimate to? Do you think, what did you think of the local, the way they lived?
Yeah, definitely. It's a different culture.
Yeah.
It's a different socioeconomic culture. You can see it. You can see sort of the different, it's easy to see the different kind of classes of people, especially when we've been going to tiny little towns,
mm-hmm.
that are pretty much self-sustaining, or they appear to be self-sustaining. And there's a really close-knit community in these smaller towns, because you couldn't get up the street through the streets of these towns because people would stop their cars and just chat and, mm-hmm. in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd see people who would pull over to the wrong side of the road to stop and get out and have a yik-yak with people. So there was a strong sense of community in the smaller cities. And then even visiting and going around and being in the shops and things, you could see, we were able really to experience a wide range of the different styles of living, I think. So it was really very interesting. And absolutely, you knew you were in a different country.
Yeah.
But the people seem to have a very positive and happy outlook, despite some of the, you know, they've had some really political, some strong and difficult political times in that country.
Well, you weren't in Northern Ireland, were you?
No, we weren't.
Okay,
Which would be probably be even more.
Yeah, definitely.
Evident. But everyone seems to be so happy and they're getting on with their lives. They're living their lives. Everyone seems to be sort of, you know, prosperous in their own way. We didn't see a lot of vagrantism or, you know, panhandling or begging or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You saw the occasional battered up old car, but people seemed to be driving, you know, healthy cars and trucks around, and there was a lot of consumerism where you could see, like, the construction industries were busy working. You were always seeing, like, trade style trucks, you know, construction workers, air conditioning vans, you know, driving around and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there seemed to be a lot of, you know, the country economy is chugging along, it seems. And the people, yeah, I think we got a really good cross-section. We met a very good cross-section of the different types of people, and they were all very charming. Mm-hmm. Everyone was just so pleasant and fun to be around and so laid back and easy to communicate with and helpful when we needed help. It was very unlike anything you'd experience in Canada or the U.S., right?
Right. So you didn't get the feel like when you go across these United States, every town kind of has this, look, there's a Cracker Barrel and there's a Gap and, you know, these right. chains. I'm sure you didn't get that feel. Like, you didn't see a Walmart anywhere, did you?
No, not at all. It was, in fact, it was hard to identify places because there was no chain. There was no chain organizational system to the stores. Mm-hmm. Every different city had a different brand name of grocery store. You could see the gas stations were all had the same names, but and many of these businesses are just family run little, you know. Single proprietor businesses, they appeared to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, every restaurant we stayed in was a different, appeared to be a family style run restaurant, or, you know, had a crew of workers. There was no sort of chain culture there at all.
Can I ask you, a lot of times when I go to the store, it doesn't really occur to me that I will run into anybody I know. And especially when I'm back home, every once in a while I would see somebody that I knew, very rarely. But there's a certain comfort for me to be kind of anonymous, right? You're just kind of like, go and do my business. I don't have to, like, chit-chat with anybody. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that you would ever feel comfortable in a culture like that where you did, like, know people and you're like, oh, there's Tony and there's JoJo and, you know, what mm-hmm. do you think about that?
I think it might be difficult for me. But then I think if you were surrounded by that all the time, you might, you know, we North Americans have a very dim view of people getting to know us because we're always sort of clutching our hearts to our chest, right, and going, oh, get away from me, I don't want you to know anything about me, I don't want to share, I got my stuff, I don't want to share my stuff or my life with you, right? So I think this makes us apprehensive of anybody, suspicious of anybody, whereas I think if you lived in that culture all the time, where it's a small country, I think they rely a lot on their neighbors and their family and community, and I think you might get used to that, and we might slough off all of these feelings we have about leave me alone, all the distrust we have with the world.
Right.
So I could see it being a difficult transition for me to adopt that attitude, but I could see that it would have benefits and that I would probably get used to it. And I might even enjoy it because mm-hmm. I don't mind talking to people on a casual basis. I quite enjoy meeting people and that kind of thing. But as soon as, if I now have to see you every day, it's a little more difficult maybe.
Yeah, because the longer you're, it's more like a work environment, you know, because once you're around somebody all the time, people, just a certain set of people all the time, then you know that you can become fodder for gossip and people getting right in your business and whatnot. That's the only drawback I see to these kind of small rural societies, is that I grew up in a town, you know, about 4,000 people, and everybody knew everybody. And that's probably why I enjoy not knowing anybody as I travel around, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, but I like the idea of feeling like you do have casual acquaintances out there that, you know, if they live down the street and some emergency came up, you could go down there and they'd be like, yes, we'll help you. Mm-hmm. That, I think that has a real nice feeling of security.
Yeah.
I know one day when I was visiting you, we were putting up the curtains I made for you, remember?
Yeah.
And we were just sitting there, and it was a little bit of a time getting the little hooks into the material. So it just occurred to me that I love that kind of old-fashioned interaction, you know, where you're just sitting there side by side. Maybe you're shucking corn or whatever. And I associate that a lot with kind of the old country like that. Mm-hmm. I find that very charming.
Yes. I think because there seem to be a lot of positives about this culture, I think if I had to live there, I think I could quite easily fit in or feel like become comfortable with a more close-knit community, because I think there's probably a lot of other benefits to that whole culture. Mm-hmm. Not just the nosy neighbors always saying hi when you step out the door, right?
Well, you can't get away from that. Remember in Hot Fuzz? That's what I think of when I think of...
Oh, yeah.
You know. Anyway. Well, Faye, it's been about an hour. Is there anything else you'd like to say about trip?
You know, it was tough. It was a tough gig because we had to do all this driving. And if I didn't, you know, by looking at the itinerary, not knowing anything, and seeing, well, I only have about a 2-hour drive every day, that seems perfectly reasonable and seems like fun.
Sure.
And you get to stop along the way and see interesting sights. But it turned out that what a 2-hour drive in North America in some cases ended up being like 6 or 7 hours. So that ended up being very long days in a car with your spouse, with a passenger who's nervous and getting lost all the time. So there were some aspects of this particular trip that were very difficult. However, overall, it was worth it in the long run, and I enjoyed myself immensely.
Good.
And I found the country to be very charming, and if I were to go back again, I don't think I need to drive 8 hours to see the cliffs of Moher.
Oh, okay.
But I would certainly enjoy hanging out in some of the bigger cities and being around the larger areas and wider group of people. And I would like to do it not have another 100 Canadians on my tail showing up every time I turn around. Aww. And everyone want to go, hey, come with us. Hey, we're going to go to the bar and sit in the bar and drink and talk about our lives back in Canada. I'm going, no, thank you.
No, thank you. I have to ask, is that how you, when you say mohair, I always think it's like mohair, like the sweater or the sheep or that it comes from, but it's connection?
I don't think so. It's M-O-H-E-R. And I don't know that I'm saying it properly either. But
well, you probably are.
And a lot of the names are very difficult. One of the places we stayed at has like 18 syllables in its name, but the locals there say Karenin.
Oh.
That's not how it's spelt, but so you never know.
Well, I don't know if this means anything, but I'm really proud that you were able to navigate and you got all the way through to the end. And I was really impressed that you were even willing to take it on, because I just thought it sounded like a nightmare just having to navigate around another country, let alone just a different city. Of course, I have no concept where I am in the world anyway, but I'm proud of you. You did it. So.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it was a good experience, and it was a challenge and kind of a trip of a lifetime, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's actually maybe we'll end on this note.
Okay.
One of the funnier things about this is every time we were sort of getting slogged down in this, like, this cattle mentality. Mm-hmm. You know, sit on this plane, jam your ass into this seat for 10 hours and don't move. You know, you can wiggle your toes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson would say, "Now remember, we're paying for this opportunity." So, you know, there's that kind of helped us to stay positive about this. Because
Mr. Anderson brought up money. That's really not like him. All right, Faye. Well, we should wrap it up. You can write and talk about your traveling experiences to fayeandbrenda@gmail.com. And Faye, I'm sure, will respond, and you can trade stories.
Right on.
All right.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.